0818-715-815.
When I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived a fair life of a rover. From Murray's Green Basin to the dirty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1916, my country said, son, it's time to stop your rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay, but amid all the cheers, flag waving and tears, we were sailed off to Gallipoli.
Christy Dignam singing Eric Bogle's classic. The band played Waltzing Matilda, adding his voice to another list of Irish voices who've given their interpretations of that song. But that raw, honest rendition of it, typical of Christy Dignam, tributes pouring into him, brutally honest, pure voiced, accessible, approachable, loved. Robbie Smith, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
How are you?
Can I start by saying I just want to offer my condolences to Catherine, Ciara, Bernie and the rest of his family. Very sad. Very sad again.
How do you know him, Robbie?
Well, I first met Chrissy over 50 years ago when we started school together in Patrician College in Finglas. We were going at the secondary school. Him and Joey Jewell, the lead guitarist of Aslan, we were all in the same class.
And what are your memories?
Great memories of, as we called him, was Disser. Wasn't Christy. Never knew him as Christy, always Disser. My memories, have great memories of him. He was great in the classroom. Always, he'd always come out with something, you know. And he was just a great guy.
He speaks very fast. Go on, yourself.
Their first group was a group called Electron. And they used to practice in the prefabs. And then they had a big gig one night up in the community centre in Finglas. So he says, we're going up, we're doing a gig, are you right? So he says, okay, no problem. And we got a shopping trolley. And we brought the gear up in the shopping trolley to the gig in Finglas. And Terry McParlin was the drummer. His dad brought the drums up in the back of the car. And it was 20 pence in.
And what was it like?
The gig, packed, jammed. Sure, there wasn't much around, like, you know. And he did great. And as every, like, they practiced and practiced and they got where they were. And brilliant.
And could you see he had it in him from the beginning when you first went up to that gig? Did you follow them on from that the whole way?
Well, I didn't have to follow them on. Sure, I was in the company. I used to hang around. I used to knock about with them. And he always had a Walkman. And he'd be listening to stuff and he'd be singing and he'd be going, what's he singing about now? And he's come out and he sang great songs, I have to say. Brilliant. He was a big David Bowie fan and Dylan. He done the Rolling Stones. He done Angie. Fantastic cover of Angie, you know.
And what was he like in school?
He was a scream. That's all I can say. He was absolutely a scream.
He didn't limit his performance to the stage, did he?
No. No, he didn't. There was always something up for him. Sometimes he'd come to school, sometimes he wouldn't. He didn't like Patrician. But he went home one time after doing the intercert, as it was called, the intermediate cert, and he got a no grade. And he told his mother it was natural genius. You know, so that's the type he was, you know. And he'd never pass you by. I met him all over the place. Met him in England. I met him here, walking down the street. His daughter, Ciara, was in my daughter's class. I'd meet him at the school, have a chat, you know. Brilliant. It's absolutely.
It seems to be a funny combination because he's a massively charismatic performer. He, you know, toured the country, met loads of people, heard people singing his own songs back to him. He must have known how loved he was, and yet there seemed to be an absence of an ego there. Was he always like that?
There was no ego in him at all. Never. Never ever came across that in this or at all. Never. He was just an ordinary guy. As he used to say to me, "We're big fish in the small pond now, Robbie." Because when he went to America, it didn't work. And he came back and they decided to go on the road here. And he packed out everywhere he went. You know?
And you worked with him briefly. It wasn't limited to school, was it?
No, he was an installer in the Post and Telegraphs. Myself and Joe Jewell, we were on the Post and Telegraphs together back in 1980. He didn't do that long in it.
Right.
He did a few years and he wanted to go singing. That's all he wanted to do was sing.
Yeah, I was only reading in Samantha Librari's book, Finglas, a people's portrait, that he switched jobs so that he'd have the same working hours as Joe Jewell so he could practice after work.
Yeah, that's what he did. It was all about practice. And that's what got him where he where, you know. Just a hell of a nice guy. I went to loads of his gigs through the years and I'd meet him afterwards. I'd be in the green room, him and Catherine, and have a chat. I have loads of pictures, you know.
When did you last talk to him, Robbie?
I tell you, the last time I talked to him was before COVID, and he did a gig down in the Stockhouse in Trim. It was just him and Joey doing an unplugged gig. And he came into the room and I seen him, and he came over and we were having a chat, we were having a laugh. I don't know whether I'm allowed to say this, but he grew up on stage and he said to the people, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, my great friend is here, Robbie Smith." He says, "My first homosexual crush." And the two chaps that were with me just, you know, that's the type he was, you know.
Right.
There's no harm in him, you know, we just get a bit of crack out.
Bit of devilment.
But I'm very sad. Bit of devilment, that's what it was, but there was no harm in him, none whatsoever.
Can you believe he's gone?
No, I can't. You know, I was actually toying with the idea of going over to the house, and I didn't want to intrude because he wasn't well. And I'm sorry now I didn't, you know. Really sorry.
Just when you heard he was sick, to pay your respects and check in, see if he was all right.
Yeah, just to go and just even wave at him in the window. And my wife kept saying to me, "You got to go do it." And it's like everything else, I will, and I never did. And I'm sorry. That's one thing I'm sorry about.
But I suppose you just wanted to respect the privacy and maybe...
Yeah, he wasn't well, so he didn't need me going over looking at him or talking to him and trying to drag a conversation out of him, you know?
And have you been playing his music today, Robbie? Have you been, or listening to the radio, listening to the songs? What does it bring back to you?
I've been listening to the songs. I've two albums on my phone and I listen to them constantly. And I heard Imelda May talking about the song for Catherine, brilliant. And just one of his songs has the line in it, "Tell the truth and shame the devil." And that's what my ma used to say when she was giving out to me, if I had done something wrong. And that brings it all back to me, you know.
And what's your first memory of him, Robbie? Do you remember the first time you met him?
The first time I met him was at the church in Finglas. We were hanging around and there was a couple of girls there. And Catherine, his wife, was there. That's how long he's with Catherine. And we were there having a general, just as kids do, hanging around. That's my first memory of him.
Was he popular with the girls?
Well, he was very popular with Catherine anyway. You know, but he was popular with everybody. Didn't matter whether you were a girl, a woman, a man, a boy. He just was absolutely brilliant with everybody. There's no one had the charisma he had when he met him. He met you on the street. He made you feel like you're the one. You know, he'd be over to you, he'd be talking to you. He wouldn't talk about music, he'd talk about anything, everything by music, actually, you know. Talk about the kids and how you're getting on and what's the story, you know. He's a great man for boards. He loved boards.
You mean the ones, the feathered ones?
The feathered ones, yeah, yeah. These canaries and these green finches and goldfinches and everything. He loved them.
All right. He spoke about this, a colleague of ours, Brendan Dunne, who made a documentary with him called Going Home. That's actually one of the things he touched on And big part of his growing up was his love of birds. Here he is on it now.
Yeah.
I used to breed birds as well out the back. That was another. I was mad into native birds, you know, finches and all that. So I used to have an aviary out the back. We used to go up to these fields just up the road here, and our kids, we used to go up there, you know, getting birds' nests and, you know, all that carry on. So I just got mad into birds through that, you know, so I started breeding them out the back. But then I didn't like to see them in the cage, you know, it used to be a bit of a bad vibe, so I let them all go. Fly free, my friends. My dad was kind of, he built the aviary with me, so he kind of had that vibe with him, you know. He used to bring me to the board marker in Bride Street every Sunday morning. All these people used to come in where Jacob's factory used to be.
That was Christy talking to Brendan Donoghue there. Robbie, do you remember the aviary his dad built for him?
I do. That's a long time ago. And his dad used to have a shed where he did a bit of upholstery, and he'd carry down chairs to the back of the house and for his dad, you know, and all that type of thing. But yeah, they had a lovely house. It was a happy house down in Cardiff Bridge. That's what I remember, you know.
And it was around that house that documentary with Brenda. He's tremendously proud of where he originally moved there from Cabra, but he considered himself a Finglas man. He was very proud of it.
Oh yeah, without a doubt, he was very proud of it. He was from just up around the corner in Abbottstown, and around the corner again was Ronnie Whelan, the Liverpool footballer. So there must have been some sort of talent around there, you know.
Yeah.
But he was very proud of where he came from. He never ever forgot it. And he used to go through things. Catherine still has her place there in Finglas, her hairdressers. She's still there.
And it gives
everybody
it like,
knows her there.
When you've got somebody as well known as that from an area and people know where he's from, it gives an area a bit of a lift.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Like all he had to do was walk down the street and all the people you know, I was talking to, as they call them, Christy, or my mother would say, I've seen this or this morning, and he was talking about you, he was telling me about you, you know. Because they were very tight around that area. Like the what you call it, Harris family was up in Mellows, and Dignams are down in Cardiff Bridge. It's not that far between them, you know, so everybody knew them. And they were great, I have to say.
Neely Mulligan, he moved to the Navan Road. That's where you're a neighbour of his and a fellow musician. Good afternoon to you.
How are you?
How are you? How are you feeling today since the news broke last night?
A great sense of sadness that poor Christie has passed. You know, we knew him since we moved in here in the early 90s, you know. And Catherine, his wife, and Kira growing up as well, you know. So, yeah, he was a wonderful neighbour. And you were talking about the birds there. The first time I think I met him, one of his birds escaped and was up on the top of the roof of our house, and he was coming over to see if he could entice it down, but didn't work, flew away, and he was very disappointed with that. But yeah, great guy, you know.
And is that the first time you got to meet him, trying to get a bird off the roof of your house?
I met him on the road, yeah, if you like. Yeah.
And
that's many years ago, yeah.
You struck up a bit of a rapport, is it? With him?
Well, you'd meet him, like, he'd be walking his dog generally, you know. He loved walking the dog, and he'd be out and about. And my wife is working in a Gael school there, Gael school Columkilla, and Christy's sister was the secretary in the school. And so we kind of knew him through her as well, you know, and she'd be updating us on Christy and the whole lot, you know. So I suppose the highlight of the whole neighbourhood thing was during lockdown, and our neighbours here, Morgan and Rosemary Kennedy, decided to organise a bit of a concert for the neighbourhood, and it was to celebrate Christy's 60th birthday. That was 2020 during the lockdown. So myself and the kids play music, so they asked us to play first, and they have a big front garden, so we went over there and we set up shop and played some tunes, and the girls did some Shannos dancing as well. And then Christy and Kira came on board, and one or two more members of his band, and they played for the neighbours, you know, which is really lovely. And it was lovely weather. They all sat socially distant, if you like, around the road and the gardens and everything. So it was really beautiful.
A much needed lift during the lockdown. We'll relive that moment here, because we actually have a bit of that concert that was played outdoors during the lockdown. Let's have a listen to it.
Protect you in this crazy world. Crazy world is all right.
He said once that there's no feeling on earth like listening to a crowd sing your own song back to you. I mean, that's a neighbourhood concert, and he's still giving it his all, giving it loads.
Yeah, because at the end of towards the end of the song, he just turned the microphone to the crowd and let them sing it. So that was very beautiful, you know. And they all sang, and he loved that, you know.
And that's you we can hear on the Illan pipe in the background in that music, is it?
Yeah, and the kids are on chisels and concertina. Niece of mine, Maeve Mulligan, is on the concertina as well. We invited her down and her family. Tom is the cobblestone. He runs the music pub there, you know.
Yeah, well known for traditional music and that.
And just to play with him, you know.
And what was he like to play with? You know, had you done much rehearsal for that?
We did no rehearsal at all. It was just spontaneous. So it was off the cuff, and that was the way it was. And he made no fuss, and he was just very relaxed and very easygoing, and you know, no pressure at all. We just sat down and played. It was lovely.
How's the mood on the road today, Neely?
Kind of sadness, I think, you know, and we're just waiting for word on what's happening and all that. So people were all gathered around yesterday, just chatting near his house and just wondering what, I suppose, you know, just that sense of sadness. And people we knew, like, he wasn't well for a good while, you know. So, of course, someone was saying, you know, 10 years ago he wasn't given much time, but he's a fighter, and he fought a great battle for the last 10 years, you know.
Yeah, I think he said he prayed for another 10.
You warm to him very easy, you know.
And you'll miss that, meeting him out on the road, him out and about.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, you see people coming and taking him away for gigs over the years or whatever, and you'd be just sitting in the car and away you go, and you'd be wondering where was he after, but it was generally somewhere around Ireland or down the country, you know. Or here in Dublin, and he loved all those gigs. And I was talking to his wife Catherine last week, and she told me that himself and Finbar Fury have recorded a couple of songs out in the studio in Portmarna, and that they haven't enough for an album, but she's intending to put them up on Spotify, and Christy and Finbar have waived any rights, and any of the proceeds will go towards the hospice in Blanchardstown, which is a great thing, you know.
Yeah, it's very generous for a man who had to push hard to make a living through music.
Exactly.
Put it up with proceeds going to the hospice is the height of generosity.
I think it's a great thing, a great gesture, you know. And like as she said, he was reared on ballads. He loved ballads, and I'd say it'll be lovely now to hear himself and Finbar together. You know, should be wonderful.
Yeah, I heard Finbar earlier on telling, I think, Ryan Tubridy that they'd recorded about 3 songs, as you said, not enough for an album, but there's that performance of the Green Fields of France. Another one, actually, by Eric Bogle. We heard the band played Waltzing Matilda at the top that he played with Finbar. We can hear a bit of that now, actually.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while, need the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done.
I can see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Young Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife lowly? Did they sound the dead march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
And it was interesting, Neely, to hear Finbar Fury say earlier on that there was no dry run for that. There was no rehearsal. They were asked for an impromptu duet on it, and that was the result of it.
And that's fantastic. And they're the best recordings, I think, ones like that, you know. Not over rehearsed or anything like that, just spontaneous and from the heart, I suppose. You know, that's the way to do it.
And as a fellow musician, Neely, just... As a fellow musician listening to the quality of his voice, it's a rare talent to be able to put that much of your personality and passion into it. People talk of, you know, the likes of Luke Kelly, that their voice has a unique character to it. He had one of those voices, didn't he?
Oh, he had a beautiful voice, yeah, and very distinctive. And, you know, when you hear him coming on the radio or on the TV, you'd know straight away who it was, you know. And he put his heart and soul. You could see the emotion in him when he'd be singing as well, you know. And composed some great songs. I mean, that one for his wife Catherine is very beautiful, you know. And I remember, like, we had another concert 12 months later for Catherine on the street, a similar street concert, and that was arranged. And we had a lovely similar sort of concert for that as well. So. It was a nice break from the lockdown, kind of a nice distraction. It was lovely.
And did he have that emotional quality about him, you know, that he brought to his singing voice? Did he have that about him when you met him along the street? Some people ask, how are you? And it just means, how are you? And some people ask, how are you? And they actually want to make that connection.
Yeah, no, he's very natural. No airs or graces, which was nice. It was, what you saw is what you got, you know. Christy was very natural and no airs or graces. And that was the nice thing about him. He could relate to him very easily and chat to him very easily, you know. Lovely man.
Nicola Coffey, we opened today playing with hearing from Christy singing. The band plays Waltzing Matilda. That's a particular favourite of yours. Tell us what your connection with Christy Dignam is.
Hi, good afternoon, Colm. I'm heartbroken here. I loved him since I was 17. I loved all their music. He was just incredible. He was wonderful. Everyone in Ireland is so gutted today, aren't they, and last night.
And can you remember the first time you heard a record by Aslan, or the first time you went out and bought one?
The first time I heard them was on the old 2FM. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Gareth O'Callaghan. And then I just loved his voice. It was so unique, and he allowed you to kind of feel your feelings through his music. I can't describe. He let everyone know that whatever they were feeling was okay. That's how I kind of fell in love with them. And then they came locally and they played live. I'll never forget it the first time. And
where was that, Nicola?
It was in Horan's Hotel in Tralee. They used to come here quite frequently. And I was 17 and I snuck in, you know, behind the bouncers and stuff. And he brought me up on stage to sing This Is.
How did you end up on stage? You were just in the front row, were you?
I was in the front row from sort of 8 o'clock that evening, before the place even opened. I was there, and it was just a fluke thing. And I remember my boyfriend at the time. He went home.
He probably didn't get a glance off you all night.
No, he didn't. He was raging.
Is that what finished the relationship, or did that?
No, not at all. No, we laughed about it afterwards, but he was like a briar, you know, and I just didn't care. I didn't care. I was in love.
And you were obviously singing along with great passion, were you?
Well, great passion, but no voice, you know, that sort of singing. But oh my God, and they've been on my favourites playlist for over 30 years now. He was just incredible and so down to earth, so lovely to talk to. And I know a lot of people have said no airs and graces, but it was true, and everything he sang about was true. And I think the older I've gotten, the more I kind of realize what he was singing about. Obviously, you do more than when you're 17, you know. But
how did that 17-year-old feel when he indicated from the audience that he was going to take you up on stage? I mean, how did that come about?
I still remember the feeling. I was just terrified, obviously, but ecstatic. I was determined I was going up there. Oh, it was wonderful. I felt like Monica out of Friends at a Bruce Springsteen concert. You know, that sort of feeling.
And were any of your friends in the audience?
Oh, they were all there. Yeah, they were all there. But they knew that, you know, I wouldn't be talking to them whenever Aslan came to play. We'd talk afterwards, but I'd be 100% focused from beginning to end. There'd be no conversation or toilet breaks or anything like that. He made my life better, I think. I really do believe that. And my deepest sympathies and condolences, obviously, to his wife, Catherine, and Kira, and Darren, and all the family. But I think we should kind of thank Catherine, too, though, for supporting him so that he could support us and sharing him with us.
It was just that vulnerability that you connected with, was it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I always have.
And this is, and thought, as a song, was, sorry, go on, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I thought Uchtarona Heron said it quite well in his tribute to him. He summed it up, you know, quite nicely about how everybody's feeling, far more than other politicians, you know. I mean, especially when he wasn't given that COVID bursary during the pandemic, I thought that was outrageous. But at least, you know, President Higgins has paid proper tribute to him, as he fully deserves and as he's deserved for the last nearly 40 years. He's one of the best things to ever come out of Ireland, and he made my life so much better.
And that song, This Is, that you sang along with on that night, let's hear from Christy explaining exactly what the inspiration behind that song was.
These are the hands of a tired man. This is the old man's
road. We're on Cardbridge Avenue of Finglas West. This is the road that is bread and butter down on. There's a grill up here, you know. These are the hands of a tired man was my dad's hand. You know, they go hard from the welts, and the feet of a punished pilgrim was my ma walking up with Crowpatrick, is it? I thought, Jesus, God doesn't want you to do that, wreck your feet, you know.
This is Christy Dignam explaining what it exactly it was that inspired that song. We'll take a break. We're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm Mamungan here, 51551 for your text. Joe at rte.ie for your emails, and WhatsApp us on 087 184 3709. The programme today given over to remembering Christy Dignam, from those who knew him to those who were touched by him, those who were affected by him, those who just simply miss him for whatever reason they had themselves and the connection they had with him. Tommy Claffey, good afternoon to you.
How are you, Colin?
How are you feeling today, Tommy?
Well, like everyone, it's so hard to think of Christy in the past tense. I'd just like to send my deepest condolences to Catherine Kira and to his grandkids that he so adored. Christy, from my generation, it was the band to see if you could get in there, you know, for you weren't out the back door. But what a musician, what a man to write lyrics. When Christy sang and he put his palms up to the ceiling, it was like he was singing from his soul. You know, he really got into the song. You could see how much passion was coming out in vocal cords. You know, and he was funny to listen to his stories about his dad doing the upholstery in CIA and bringing the material home, that they had couches, you know, made out out of that looked like
the leather bus.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, he loves, as an old caller there said, he loved his boards, and a customer of mine up at the cemetery is a good friend of his wife Catherine, and she told me at Christmas that he wasn't too well, and I had these little boards, finches and robins with Santa's hats on them, and I said to Susan Doyle, I said, Susan, bring them over to Christy. I said, he mightn't have a navy any longer, but he might get a laugh out of the robins and the finches with the Santa hats on them. Now, I was listening today to Imelda May, and you know, the way, and about the duet that both of them done together for his wife Catherine, and then I heard Dave Fanning come on, and I wasn't too happy with what Dave was saying. You know, Dave was saying that he blew it, and Chrissy would say that himself. You know, but I don't think Chrissy blew it. He had hiccups in his career, and he went away to Thailand, and he got the demon sorted, and if anything, he come back and he reinvented himself as a man, as a father, as a human being, and he didn't want to be going around in limousines waving out the window. Christy Dignam was a people's person, and he never forgot his roots. He wrote and sang about them, and like what he also did was, you know, anyone that had any sort of addiction, you could look at Christy and say, well, he got over it. He fought it. And he come out the other side, so there's no reason for you to throw, you know, your head in a cardboard box and forget about life has passed you by, you know. But
and you're a flower, just to explain where you came across the robins and the finches with the Santa hats on them. You're a flower seller in Palmerstown, Tony.
Yeah, I'm a flower seller at Palmerstown Cemetery, and Susan Doyle she used to keep me up to date and how Christy was doing. You know, I'd love him to sit down and talk to him, because we kind of, in some ways, had a parallel life without going into anything else. But he was just a fabulous singer, and I mean,
something in him, and I appreciate you don't want to go into it, but you know, There was something in Christy's story, something in his battles and the vulnerability, and at the same time the strength he showed, that connected with you alongside the music, is it?
Yeah, yeah. It's, look, a lot of people gave up. gave up on Christy when the band had to sack him, right? And he come back, you know, and he come back. I think he come back stronger, because He'd been one side of the pond, and he came through the swamp, and he carried all the battle scars with him. And for Dave Fanning to say that he blew it, Dave should have said he blew it, but he come back reinvented as. And I mean, I was down in the local pub last night, and everybody in the pub, I said, "Did you hear about Christy Dignam?" And they all just put their head down, you know. Because he's one act that will never be followed. He brought music to every corner of the island, and you know, packed out parish halls and country little venues. You know.
And did you ever get to meet him, Tommy?
No. Well, he came to the stall one day with Catherine. Catherine's young child died tragically, and they were buying flowers for the grave. But you know, I just how was it going? You know, but I just it's so hard. We all know the day was coming, but when I read it yesterday, my heart sank for him, because he was trying to, there was a drug on trial, and then a couple of years ago he thought this could be the one that it'll affect his cancer, but sadly it wasn't, you know. Yeah. But when he was getting interviewed, you got what he was, you know. There was no, you wouldn't see, I don't think you'd see Christy in the late green room saying, take them yellow M&Ms out of the glass, because I don't like them, you know. Not a prima donna,
yeah.
Not at all, no, absolutely not.
Thanks, and, Tommy. Regina Lipa, you go back to the 1980s, you're an addiction counsellor, and Christy Dignam, as a role model for triumphing over addiction, the stumbles, the falls, the try-agains.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what was the reason I wanted to email in, just to, you know, honor him, because there must be hundreds, maybe thousands of people that he helped, and he would have never known that he helped them in terms of reducing the stigma and the guilt around addiction. That's what, you know, kept people trapped in addiction, was the stigma and the guilt, and they never picked up the phone and looked for help. And then people like Christy came along as a role model. And I suppose for everybody, and not only people, if this can happen to Christy and he can get well, maybe I can get well too. The other piece is, it wasn't a straight road for him. There were relapses. Of course, it was all a bit public, but for a lot of my clients over the 40 years, it would have been, well, maybe I can come back, and relapse is not the end of the road either. So, you know, I think we have him a lot to thank for in that regard.
And he was very open about, you know, issues he had overcome that never fully over, or that never fully leave you, probably, if you've been a survivor of abuse. But he did suffer abuse at the hands of two different people, and he was open about that, which maybe gave an insight into some of the context of his addiction.
Yeah, and therefore also the context for, you know, the majority of people in addiction, they don't become addicts because, you know, it's such great fun. It is, so for 99% of people, it's trauma in the background of one shape or other. So again, he brought it out into the light. He said, this is what happened to me. So again, there's probably hundreds and thousands of people he helped to pick up the phone to those services and to begin their journey in healing from the abuse and their childhood. So, yes, you know, so we should be very grateful for people like Christy who helped a lot of people. And he was part of one of our recovery walks. Every year we would set out and all the services would come together and roads would be closed, the Connell Street or Connell Bridge be closed, and thousands of us would walk. And in 2015, Christy and the band, they sang at the end of the recovery walk. And, you know, that's again one of these highlights. I just found the photos and sent one in. So, you know, those are special moments that certainly I will always carry with me. So thanks, Christy, and rest in peace.
And as he said in his first album, Aslan's first album title, Feel No Shame, that's part of the recovery story, isn't it? Overcoming that misplaced shame that holds people back.
Absolutely. And I have to say, in the 40 years that I've worked in the field, it certainly has been reduced. There have been others like Christy who have, you know, come out and talked about it. And the shame is a toxic shame, which, you know, doesn't get anybody well. And maybe we can now start to believe in Ireland addiction can happen to anybody. There's nobody immune.
And maybe it's a good way to remember Christy Dignam, is it? That people, you know, look at addicts along the street and maybe don't dismiss them with pejorative labels or insulting words, that they maybe see that there is hurt behind the addiction and that there's always hope for people.
And there's hope and there's services for everybody in the audience. People can go to the private places for, if they're insured. There's the free services all across the city and the country. There's hope for everybody who's listening today who's still in addiction. Yes.
And for anyone for whom Christy was a bit of a guiding light, someone who kept them going, where, you know, he had falls on the road and got himself up and recovered again and still had the misfortune to have the illness he had to recover from. For anyone who sees the kind of pessimistic side of that, Regina, what would you say to someone who feels they've lost a guiding light today in Christy and their journey with addiction?
Well, I suppose, again, you know, he's now a guardian angel for so many. And again, we don't know what's around any corner, but do the best you can today. Stay well, stay sober and clean. And if you have health concerns, do the best you can to get them looked after. But, you know, Christy would want you to not relapse. He would want you to stay well because he was a real fighter and a survivor.
A survivor indeed. Okay, we're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
On Sunday mornings, he used to make the dinner. That was the one day he kind of did all the dinner, you know, the roast or the chicken or whatever it was, you know. He used to put on John McCormick records and Caruso and stuff on a Sunday, and he'd be singing along with the records. And that, I think that gave me the love of singing, you know, and that kind of love of music and stuff. There was one, Your Tiny Hand Is Frozen, all that, Nessie and Dorma, all those songs that kind of came out years later. I kind of known them from then, you know.
That was Christy Dignam talking about his father listening to opera music while he was cooking the Sunday dinner. Colm O'Mungine here, 51551 for your text as we remember Christy Dignam, celebrate his life. joe@rte.ie or WhatsApp us 087 184 3709. Harry Crosby, how are you today?
Very well, thank you very much.
He sang in a number of your venues. People know you as an entrepreneur and the man behind venues like The Point and The Board Gosh and Vicar Street.
Yes. Well, he did indeed, and I knew him for many, many years. But I'd kind of become an expert at watching great performance and seeing what makes them tick. And in a strange way, they all have a thing in common. There's a kind of a mysterious power that lies underneath the music, and Christy could tap into that. And what he was able to do was to communicate direct to the person in the crowd. And the crowd is wise. They always know when they have the real deal up in front of them. And Christy knew that. And when I watched him many, many times. He was able to communicate heart to heart in the crowd. And they knew. And if you stand at the back of a big crowd, when you see a truly great performer up there, they kind of relax and he makes them feel better about themselves. And at that really intimate level, it's nothing to do with music anymore. And he was a genius at that. And I saw Bono do it, and I saw Frank Sinatra do it many, many years ago in the Old Point. Frank Sinatra was a very, very grumpy old man. We couldn't please him. I did everything to try and make him happy. Right. But when he walked on stage, the age fell away and the lights came on. And a lot of them double in size. He speaks slowly, and he hung his hat up on the microphone, and he said hello, and he had them. Simple as that. It's a mystery. It's a magic. Some people have it, some don't. And Christy had it. And I saw Bono do it. Myself and Rita were invited a few times out on tour with him. We flew from Milan in a heat wave into Turin. There was a two-hour logjam in the traffic. The show was late. There was 100,000 people in a sweatbox. And he walked out on stage in absolute silence, got down on his knees and said, "I'm sorry," in Italian. And he had 100,000 people in his palm of his hand. And Christy could do that as well. And it's some weird, strange, wonderful gift of communication that, as I said, has very, very little to do with music. And he was one of the reasons that Vicar Street has become such a part of the fabric of the city was because of his early gigs. Because when I opened it first, it was meant to be the Christy Moore Centre, and there was only 500 seats, but he was the real deal, the genuine article, and people knew that when he was talking to them, he was talking only to them, and that's the secret of them, that intimacy that you get, particularly in a small, intimate venue like Vicar Street, and he was the master of it, so I will miss him a lot.
And what is it that people have that relationship with him? We heard from Nicola earlier, you know, there was something about him that she developed a connection, or, you know, Tommy, who for his own reasons felt that he had some point of connection with Christy or saw some parallel in Christy's life, that people bring all of that into a venue. And what that singer has is maybe, you know, the combined power of all of those connections, well, real or imagined?
You know, very, very little to do with music, actually. It's really just about humanity. That's what the great performers have. And, you know, when you go back into him, and I saw it in Sinatra, even though he was a horrible, he wasn't a nice man, actually. But when he was out on the stage, he had that stripped away thing about you're looking at a human soul out there, giving all he could possibly give. And Bono can do it. And he can bring an audience to tears by, I don't know what magic. And particularly, they all can do it. They do this thing. They move slowly. They seem to swell up in size. They seem to be slightly puzzled that they're out there. They seem to be partly outside their own body. And all of that translates absolutely directly into the audience. As I said, an audience is a very wise thing, and they know it when they see it, and they relax and they feel comfortable and they never forget it. And he had that power.
You say Frank Sinatra was a difficult personality. What about, you know, Christie? Most people say very approachable, very amenable.
Yeah, I was never really a friend of his. I only knew him through work, but I had a good laugh with him. Even recently there, we opened up the back of Vicar Street for the Women's Centre with the Red Cross for the Ukrainian ladies, and he put on the show, and the crack was that I was going to get up and sing my medley, and he was going to be my backing singer. And there's a great joke that when he heard me sing, I was so good he got jealous and wouldn't let me up. And that went on for a long time, but that sort of acted the Egypt stuff. But I just liked him. He was just an ordinary head to me. He never. We don't buy into the fame stuff. We don't get involved in that at all, because actually 99% of fame is just a marketing tool, and we disregard it. But he didn't care about that. He was just a nice man, and I shall miss him.
And Harry, what was it about, you said that he was the makings of Vicar Street in the beginning. What was it? He was a banker to fill it, was he?
Because he was the spirit of what Vicar Street was. It was built up in a working class area. And the same as when I opened the Point, everybody said, your man is mad, it will never work. And, you know, I was up there every night at the start wondering, will people come up here? Nobody ever went up to Thomas Street for anything like that. It was a small venue. It hadn't been particularly well finished because I didn't have the money to do it. And he just picked up the spirit of the place. And he became, in the early days, the spirit of Vicar Street. And then Peter Aiken came in, and he was able to bring the firepower of a really big, important promoter behind it. But it was all about the local people buying into the fact that one of their own was doing well in a place. And he was one of our own. And he reckoned that I was one of his own as well. And it was that spirit that I think brought it over from being just another commercial venue into being what it has become, which I'm amazed when I hear it, that people absolutely love the place. And During the big lockdown, I was under pressure to close it down and put up 40 or 50 or 150 apartments, and people went mad. They said, you can't shut down Vicar Street, you're mad. So he was part of the building of that mythology of the place.
Dermot Smith, people recognised his genuineness because he never forgot his own.
100%, Colin. How are you? How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'd like to send my condolences to Catherine and the family from myself, Lydia, and my family. I know Christy, they say centuries from way back in the day when we were starting off playing. I was with a band called Montage. They were Amelia 18. We were, as Aslan, we were on the same label, Rika's Records. Just talking there about Christy and in a way of connecting to his audience. And on a spiritual level, sometimes I watch them sometimes. And if you look at the people at the front row, they were doing the same hand movements. They were doing it, and it was all in unison with Christy. Do you know what I mean? Like it was
like a prayer meeting.
It was timing, and they knew his timing.
So they'd obviously been at.
Can you hear me okay there?
I can, yeah. But you're. I mean, obviously, from what you're saying, these people were devotees. They'd seen these moves and gigs before, and they were back for more every time.
Yeah, but I think they were mesmerized. I think they were in the trance. You know,
like, I'm going on the human side of Christy, and I have a fantastic story. I hope you'll let me tell it.
Sure, fire away.
I work at Dublin Airport, airport security. I have for the last 17 years. I found a family that I connected to, and the Barrett's family, Ian and Mary. They have three boys, Brandon, Keane and Caleb. And they have a rare debilitating disease. It's Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's a debilitating disease of the bones. Like, I got Chris or Billy and Rod to do a gig, and I put on benefit nights because I needed support for the family. I asked Christy and Joe, would they do a benefit for me?
This is Joe Jewell from
Aslan. Joe Jewell and Christy and Joseph. Of course we would. Now, the fantastic thing about this whole story is that coming up to the concert, I got a call a day or two to say, Christy's after being asked to sing with Bono U2 at the Tree Arena. It's coinciding on the same night, which is the 27th November 2015. And it was, we were doing our benefit in the Radisson. And the book stopped with me, Colin. Everything... I had set the whole thing up. And, you know, on the night and close to it, I'm saying, God, I hope Christy turns up. Jeez, you know, he walked in through the doors, him and Joe. We set him up into it. He never mentioned nothing about the gig that was asked of him to sing along with U2 at the Tree Arena. That was never mentioned. In the end, what Christy done was, he put on an incredible show. We supported the family. But what was more incredible, he never mentioned anything about the fact that he was asked to sing with U2. He wouldn't give up on the boys. He wouldn't say, no, look, you know what I mean? I'm singing with U2 and Bono. It was never in his mind whatsoever. He was supporting the children and he wouldn't let them down. What do you think of that for a story, Colin?
And he didn't want to let you know that this was a favour or that you were under any compliment to him.
Do you know what, Colin? He did that gig like he did every other gig. He wasn't rushing. He sang till the end. It was an incredible night. We supported the Barrett boys who needed a bigger fish. I tried to get Dennis O'Brien because I'm working at the airport. So I thought and I was trying to get on the late to try and help him years down. But I asked Christy, and I just thought it was just synonymous with him for his human side, and it was just magnificent.
And did he make the gig in the Tree Arena, or was it just
the next night? I believe they sent the car for him and Catherine. I think they were doing three nights, Colin. I'm not 100%. It could be two nights, but there was no call of him reneging on my night to support the boys and the Barrett family. That wasn't in his mindset whatsoever. No interest whatsoever. He was there on our night. And if Bono or the U2 were to ask him the next night, would you come along then? No problem, because he had that night, but he had made a commitment to us and to a family, a very ordinary family, who need support from this. This is an ongoing... it's something that was close to my heart for so many years and still is, but I lost my mum my dad through COVID. He died through COVID.
And
my
mum
has Parkinson's in a nursing home now, and I just couldn't support it for after that. But that was one of the stories that I thought was just synonymous with Christy as a person and as a human, and how down to where he was, that he wouldn't renege on a family that needed his support.
Well, as you say, just generosity and...
It was fantastic. I've been pals with him and Tony McGuinness, Billy, all my life and even though they'd be out gigging and all going this way and that way and they were going to America and all that, they'd always keep in touch, Tony, and they'd always keep in touch. And Christy was a fantastic human being, magnificent, really, and... It was a human story that I thought was so important to be told.
And well told.
It went viral after that because people knew that he had done it, you know. A word got around and whatever. But that's my story, and I'll miss Christy. I've known him so long, and our best wishes are with Catherine and the family, Kira, and all
and indeed so say all of us. Sonia Corcoran, you're calling us from Tipperary.
Hi, how are you, Colin? To start off with, I suppose Christy is just a legend. I know to everyone, like, just, you know, practically everyone in the country has something to say about Christy, and it's all good, I'm sure. And I suppose in my case, I love him, like, and I've been a fan of his for as long as I can remember, but very fortunate that twice in my life I met Christy. And I suppose the first time, it was about, I'd say around 20 years ago, he was coming to play a gig in Clonmel, and there was a competition on the local radio for tickets and a meet and greet with the band. So I entered anyway, and luckily I won. And my sister was just literally after having a baby, of course, onto the phone to her, you have to come. So the two of us took off anyway to Clonmel to Christy, and a wonderful gig, absolutely fantastic as they all were. And then we were brought in to a room backstage to meet with Christy, and like the generosity of him is what I can really remember. He sat with us, I would say, for a good 40 minutes. He chatted, he answered all our questions. He told us all about his time in Thailand. We had a laugh, and, you know, he was just unbelievable after such a long gig, and, like, you know how much he puts into his gigs, you know, and he was probably wrecked, and he sat and gave us that time, which, like, for us at the time, we were just blown away by, you know. And then we went and we came out, and Billy and the boys were playing pool, and they played pool with us for a while. I mean, it was just phenomenal, really. Like, we were younger back then, we were absolutely goggle-eyed by it all. But the best story, I suppose, was, I think, 2017, if I'm correct. He was playing in Golden, which is very near me. It's only a very small village, and this is another part of Christy. Like, he'd play in all the small venues as well as the big venues. You know, he wasn't snobbish about it. He gave his time to everybody. But we were going to that gig, and my best friend, Sarah Flynn from Cashel, Sarah had kind of gotten to know Christy through gigging around as well, just as a fan, but had gotten to know him. And when he was coming to Cashel, he texted Sarah, or rang her. He got in contact with her some way anyway. We had won, I think it was the Munster final. Tipperary had won that day.
Right.
And he said to Sarah, is there any chance you could get me a Tip jersey for the show tonight, you know? So Sarah anyway thought of me. I love the hurling. So Sarah rang me and she said, any chance Christy is looking for a Tip jersey for tonight? I said, leave with me, no bother. I knew mine wasn't suitable, but on to my brother Martin anyway. And I said, oh, he said, Jesus, give it to him. I'd love him to wear me jersey. So
did you let him keep it?
Well, he wouldn't keep it. We wanted him to keep it, but he insisted on giving it back. I swear to God, we wanted him to have it. Martin said, Jesus, make sure that man keeps that jersey. No, he said, under no circumstances, you wouldn't take it on it. But
maybe he was afraid to cross the border back into Dublin wearing anything other than a Dublin jersey.
I don't know, he might have gotten way too handy getting that into Dublin. But while I was sitting at home that evening, it was a Saturday evening, and we were waiting. The girls were to come here, Sarah and a few, when we were going down to the gig. And I was in my kitchen, and next thing, the back door was open. It was a lovely summer's evening, and we heard this knock on the back door. Hello, is Sonia there? I knew the voice. My heart nearly stopped inside my chest. Christy had come to my house, gotten off Sarah to where I was living, arrived on into my kitchen. I mean, I was absolutely blown away. He came in, he sat down with all of us.
Were you too blown away to make him a cup of tea?
He wouldn't even have the cup of tea because he had a Chinese ordered, would you believe? And he had to get back down to the boys that were going to have a Chinese before they went on stage. So he wouldn't even have the cup of tea. Oh, stop. But I mean, he sat down with us. Like, I have the pictures, I have the video of him coming in the back door, the lads caught it on their phones. And just, he was just phenomenal. He was so down to earth. He, you know, there was no airs and graces about Christy Dingham. And like every gig you went to, you were blown away by it.
Right,
you just, because like the previous caller said, you felt he was singing to you nearly. You know, he was just such a personable man, and he's such a loss to the whole country, and just huge sympathy to his family, because I'm sure they're deeply, deeply missing him. But he was one in a million, and he'll never be replaced.
Good stuff. Well, I hope those memories get you through today. We're back with more after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
This is for all the latent hippies.
Do you want to introduce it?
No.
Okay, see, can you spot what it is?
Yeah.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell and blue skies from pain? And can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil? And do you think you can tell? And did they get you to trade your heroes for ghosts, hot ashes for trees, and hot air for cool breeze, and cold comfort to change? And did you exchange a walk-on part in the war for a lead role in a cage?
That was Aslan and Christy Dignam, obviously performing Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd, a song the band wrote, kind of an ode to Syd Barrett, who the band lost and missed very much when he had mental health difficulties as a result of his use of drugs. But Neil Featherston Haw, you wrote the biography with Christy Dignam. Wish You Were Here is a kind of an apt song to be playing today, I'm sure, from your point of view.
I don't know. I'm just listening to it there and he nails it, doesn't he? He just... You know, those songs are considered untouchable by fans, that and Angie as well. And Christy just made them his own, I think, really. You know, he just had that range and that vocal ability that he could get on stage and knock those songs out. And some people, I remember back when we started writing the book, I'd be at gigs, various gigs, you know, they thought they were Aslan songs. You know, he just owned those songs. So I think it's appropriate.
Your journey began with him. He wanted to go to somebody he trusted. You'd written about the Stardust families, and he was very much somebody rooted in his area. And that's what attracted him to working with you to write a very open, very brutally honest book about his life.
Yeah, like, you know, Christy, you know, he's a North Sider, he's a Dub. He you know, would have lived in that community that's very much affected by the Stardust fire. So that was one of the first things that we spoke about when we sat down together. I didn't know Christy, by the way, at all. I was introduced to him by a common friend. So I was meeting him as a complete stranger. I wasn't a fan of Aslan, I hesitate to say at the time. So we were sitting down as complete strangers. But that is something that he did mention to me straight off the bat. You know, there was a musical connection there as well. He felt, you know, as much as the community did throughout Dublin, much affected by that. So that was one of the first topics that came up. And yeah, it was, you know, it's strange thing sometimes about really, really well-known, perhaps famous people, musicians like Christy, you know, they can get on stage and knock it out to 10,000 people, no bother. But in person, they could be quite shy and retiring. You know, and when I first met Christy, I remember in the house of Clontarf, he was almost like, you know, popping his head around the door, you know, and I was like, hey, Christy, how are you doing? And he was all sheepish and kind of shy. That's the first thing that struck me about him. Also, he was very small. I just remember he's this light little figure, you know. He's like an imp with this kind of like great colour in his eyes and great spark. But we sat down and level of trust that had to be involved there that we built up very quickly because it was a ridiculously tight short deadline for the book. I think we knocked it like 4 months or something like that. So we had to very quickly start getting into each other's lives. And, you know, he straight, once he got talking, there was no stopping to him. He's a great raconteur, a great storyteller, very funny. Even when we talk about some of his more darker periods in his life and with Aslan, he could tell it with that just great Dublin wit and sociability and, you know, ability to kind of keep you interested. He's great, really good.
And do you think what he revealed in the book about the abuse in his childhood, providing the context for the addiction that he went through later in life, he took to heroin later, much later, when I think he was only about 28 years of age. But do you think it lent some understanding to to Christy Dignam and his story to people who maybe had been possibly more judgmental of him in his career before that?
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, Christy was very, you know, reluctant. So he's very careful. He's very cautious. He's talked about his drug use, you know, which way he phrased it, and to pin it on certain reasons or whatnot. But that's the way he described it to me. When he first took heroin, this hole, this gaping hole in his soul, as he called it, you know, the after effects of the abuse, that went away. Nothing ever, you know, worked for him right up to that point. He always had that kind of, well, I, you know, it's hard to kind of understand, but, you know, that's the way he described it to me, a hole in his soul. When he took heroin, that all went away. So that was, you know, he didn't use heroin to get high, is one way he put it to me. He took heroin to feel better.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, so it became a whole other hole that he had to dig his way out of in life and managed by the end to come out of that. Neil, we're going to have to go to a break. I'm sorry, because the clock is against us.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
That's our lot for today. On sound was Liam Mullen. BCO was broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. The producer today was Nadine Maloney. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and Catherine Thomas is next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.